Maine Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Your tomatoes ought to be doing well. They're going to love this coming week. So will a lot of other plants. You're going to see a lot of growth. It's going to be a really great week. You know, one of the things, this is the season of flowers. Along the Gulf Coast in Alabama, the season of flowers. And for some reason, that gets people really frustrated at times. There are some flowers that are obnoxious. And rightly so, perhaps. I mean, you just kind of hold your nose when the pears start blooming. Yeah. Put your nose in a pear sometime when it's in flower. You'll see what I mean. But there's some other flowers that, some great flowers blooming, but there's some other flowers that cause some annoyance this time of year. Probably they shouldn't. They shouldn't at all. Your vegetables are going to be going to flower. Everything. If you overwintered vegetables, your broccoli's going crazy right now. You can't keep up with it. If you overwintered collards, if you overwintered kale, you know, the mustards, they're all going to seed right now. They're all flowering. And you think, good Lord, I don't want them to flower. This is not right. Because it's going to quit the leaf production. But let me tell you, this is something I had to learn. It frustrated me that everything was in flower this time of year, including my kale, including my mustard, including my collards. And they're all in flower now. You know what? Those flowers are absolutely delicious. It is the great pleasure of March and April in Alabama, on the Gulf Coast, in Florida, in Mississippi, to have things go to seed this time of year. They are absolutely delicious. Break off the tops. Now, as they progress and as they get seedy, they're not so good. But break off the tops of those young flowers on the tops of your collard plants, on the tops of your cabbage plants if they're flowering. Just break off the tops and chew on them. They all have a distinctive flavor. They're all delicious. There's a tremendous amount of sweetness all mixed in. It's a great time of year. And it's, you know, there's an old name for it. It's called Rob. So you hear things like, you hear names like Broccoli Rob. And basically, it means that the plants go into flower. And there are all sorts of Rob out there right now that are really fun in the garden. You can do all sorts of things with them. You can kind of stir fry them. You can put them in a frittata. They're all delicious. It's a great time of year for flowers. Don't let the fact that your greens are going to flower put you off. There's lots of great Rob out there. Lots of great things to eat. You know, there's a lot of other flowers going on, and it occurs to me that we had better talk about bulbs. And I want to give them a little bit of thought this morning, because people get focused on the wrong kind of bulbs, and every now and then I need to remind us where we are and what we do well. And tulips aren't our best sort of bulb. And there's no reason to relegate yourself to tulips. Let's talk about bulbs for a second. First off, if it's blooming now in your garden, if it's blooming in spring, it should have been planted last fall. Something we said, that's true for almost everything. If it's a spring flowering bulb, you want to plant them in fall. And let me just start with the thing that where we all start, which is the narcissus group, which includes things like daffodils and jonquils and paper whites. We do some jonquils very well, very well. I will tell you that we do many daffodils very poorly. And it's not that we can't do some daffodils really great. We do. In fact, the South was the center of daffodil growing for a long time until people up north decided, well, we want our own varieties. And then all of the emphasis went into breeding for northern varieties that need a lot of chilling. We can't grow, if you get a bulb catalog, if you get a catalog in the mail from some bulb place in Michigan, that should be a red flag to you, because Mobile ain't a lot like Michigan. It just ain't a lot like Michigan. It's a very different climate. Now, the people are probably more alike than you want to admit. But the climate is very different. Very different in those two places. And the bulbs that survive in Michigan don't do well on the Gulf Coast. We don't get enough winter chilling. That's right. You have to have some cold for some types of bulbs. But we do some narcissus really good. We do great. We do well, whatever the right adjective is in this case. We do right well with many, many narcissus. And we can talk about that. You buy those in fall. They're great. You plant them in fall. They bloom in spring if they're well adapted for us. Paper whites are some of the best for us. We can talk about that. If you have any questions about those jonquils in particular, you give me a call. We'll talk about them. But I want to talk about bulbs generally, because usually when we talk about bulbs, the only thing we can talk about is what grows in Michigan. Tulips. What if you could grow amaryllis in your garden instead of tulips? Just imagine if amaryllis could replace tulips in your garden. Well, welcome to the Gulf Coast. Welcome to the Gulf Coast. Because if you have a choice between these spectacular amaryllis in all sorts of colors and forms, incredible, and tulips, I don't know that there's a good comparison. Tulips are fine. And I've got some tulips. They do okay. Not many, but one or two. But amaryllis, man, what a stunning thing. Amaryllis, those are the kinds of bulbs we do on the Gulf Coast. They're the kind of bulbs we do well in Alabama. Hymenocallis, I wish I had another name for them. Up in Birmingham, they're called Cahaba lilies. Down on the Gulf Coast, they're called, we call them Delta lilies sometimes. Some people call them spider lilies, which is a name we give to lots of different kinds of things. It's very confusing, our common name thing. But they're these beautiful lilies, these absolutely stunning lilies that Alabama does so well. And we have so many different varieties of Hymenocallis, these beautiful, stunning tropical lilies that grow native in Alabama because we're nearly subtropical. And they have these beautiful long white petals and this little crown in the center. Absolutely the most amazing flower you've ever seen. That's the kind of things. Crinums. We do crinums incredibly well. That's the name we need to know. We don't need to know the name tulip. We need to know the name crinum. Crinum lilies are beautiful. They're stunning. They're incredible. We've got native ones. They've been a tradition along the Gulf Coast forever. Milk and wine lilies. All sorts of crinum lilies. They bloom really well for us all year long. Huge lilies, gigantic lilies. Gingers. Gingers are kind of they're a rhizome, but that's where we group bulbs. And we have all kinds of gingers we can grow here on the Gulf Coast that can't even be grown farther north. And they do beautifully here. They're of all sizes. That's what we need to be thinking about when we think about bulbs, not tulips. Rain lilies. I mean, rain lilies are, compared to jonquils, rain lilies are incredible. We have so many different kinds of rain lilies and so many different kinds of colors, orange and yellow and pink and deep red, pure white rain lilies. Great tradition along the Gulf Coast and throughout Alabama. And lycoris. The things we call spider lilies, the red spider lilies of fall, the ones that come up in September naked, but there are also golden ones that we call hurricane lilies, the yellow hurricane lilies. There's the peachy lycoris that I call that we're now beginning to see more of. There are lycoris that are blue with pink tips, incredible bulbs, and yet we still talk about tulips like we live in Michigan. all these, I haven't even started. I could talk about the erythemas. I could talk about, oh, the voodoo lilies. We should talk about voodoo lilies someday. Man, these incredible, all these different kinds of bulbs that we could be growing along the Gulf Coast. And we order from a Michigan bulb catalog and we get tulips. Too bad. Too bad. Let's figure out where we are with these bulbs. As with most things, let's enjoy the flowers of the season. Let's enjoy the flowers that do well along the Gulf Coast. Hey, give me a call. 251-343-0106. If you've got questions about what can grow in your yard, about what's coming up, let's talk about it. We got some good rain coming, and we need it. It's been a little dry, but we got some good rain coming up, so we can look forward to that this week. But meanwhile, give us a call. 251-343-0106. You can text me, too, if you got some pictures and you want to text me.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. Mississippi and Florida Sunday morning. Listen, we're going to be talking a little bit about where we are. I had a debate this morning. I was thinking, should I talk about azaleas or should I talk about bulbs? And I decided to talk about bulbs, but based on the pictures I'm getting from text, I should have talked about azaleas. Well, I got a lot of questions about bulbs too, and we're going to come back to them. But let's talk about azaleas for just a minute because we got some great pictures. Here's the big 60-year-old, as it's described, blooming down in Irvington. What a beautiful thing. Jim in Irvington sending me this. Just a – what an immense azalea. Azaleas, you know, azaleas like they used to be all along the Gulf Coast, really fabulous-looking things, spreading out over – gosh, it's the size of a house. It's the size of a house. Isn't that incredible? Can you imagine azaleas like that? We used to have them all the time. And, of course, Hal, down on Dog River, has sent me a beautiful picture, one 30 feet in diameter. Absolutely beautiful thing. Again, the size of a house. And Jim in Georgetown sends me a picture of, and these are the southern Indians that I'm getting pictures of, these big, beautiful hoop-skirted things. But Jim in Georgetown sends me a picture of Spring Sensation in full bloom. Now, Spring Sensation is an old Aromi hybrid, well, a middle-aged Aromi hybrid. But don't let middle-aged put you off. It's a beautiful thing. It's been around for a while, but it is a beautiful plant, one of the great plants, one of the earliest to bloom, as Jim points out, of the native azalea hybrids. Now, it's a hybrid that includes a lot of our native azaleas. We're going to talk about what native means here in just a minute, but it's a very different because it's a deciduous azalea. It loses its leaves. It's not an evergreen, but boy, are they stunning when they're in bloom. There's no leaves to hide the blooms. It's just this incredible display of these very long-stemmed, very fragrant, exceptionally beautiful things. Boy, do we do azaleas well. Boy, I hope we never forget that. I know we nearly have. It's a shame. And we now let Home Depot, somebody in New Jersey pick our azaleas for us, and we are the worse off for it. I hope that you rediscover what we do really well in terms of azaleas along the Gulf Coast. They're really great. What a great spectacle that we still have some. If you see these big azaleas, you call and ask me about them. Let's talk about how to get them. They're really important azaleas. Really great things for us to have. The azaleas are looking beautiful. Really beautiful. Josh asked me, but we did decide to talk about bulbs just a little bit. And because there's a lot of bulbs out there right now, and the amaryllis are going to be blooming. If they're not blooming now, they're going to be blooming in your yard. They're going to be blooming any day now, usually around the 1st of April. They really kick off. And amaryllis are these incredible bulbs. I mean, think about it. And people say, well, we can't do tulips here. What a miserable place to live. And then you got these amaryllis that are just absolutely stunning. For everything that we don't do well, we do other things twice as well as anybody else. I mean, they're just incredible. The amaryllis are beautiful. Take a look at those amaryllis. They're blooming now. They're going to start blooming now. If they're not in your yard, they're going to be blooming there pretty soon. Think about what a great spring spectacle it is, and think about how do we cultivate things like that rather than trying to imitate what Michigan does, which is dealing with its own constraints of being Michigan. Cold, short seasons, not much rainfall. How do we do what we do well here? Somebody says, well, you know, not just amaryllis, but things like iris. Yeah, so there's all kinds of iris, and we could try to do the iris that people in Michigan do. But you know what? Those iris don't do so well for us. What do well are the Louisiana iris. We have incredible iris that do well along the Gulf Coast. They're as spectacular, if not more spectacular, than any iris in the world. And they love our wet soils, and they do beautifully here. Another kind of great bulb, actually a kind of a rhizome, but that's okay. We call them bulbs if you like. And it's the broad name we give. Iris are great for us if we choose the so-called Louisiana iris, which are native to Alabama as well as Louisiana. Incredible things. They're blooming out in the Delta. They'll be blooming out in the Delta here. Oh, in another 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to start seeing tons of iris in the Mobile Tensaw Delta. We'll see tons of iris along the Mississippi Delta, tons of iris growing up along the Pascagoula Bottoms, tons of iris in the Black Belt. It's incredible what we can do with our native iris. All kind of great bulbs. Nice thing to think about. It's a good thing to think about. So somebody says, I've tried to transplant iris from my mother's place in Troy, and I have not been successful. She has beautiful beds with white, purple, and yellow. So let me, there's a kind of an iris line. And that iris line is, as you move closer to the Gulf Coast, where it gets more, you get more rainfall, a lot of bearded iris are not going to do well along the Gulf Coast. Nope. No bearded iris. Louisiana iris are the things, and they are as beautiful, more beautiful. What your mother did in Troy may not be what you do in Mobile, because she lived in Troy. You know, and sometimes those things don't transfer, because plants, oh, you know, we're people. We get a job in New York City, and we move to New York, and we're, you know, we have all of the air conditioning and all those things that make people happy. But plants aren't that way. They're about climate. They're about where they are, and they don't transfer well always from one city to another. So it was an heirloom for your mother, but it was an heirloom because it was an heirloom for that particular place. And it did well for her there because she was there. You'll have to take her memory and her knowledge of gardening with you, but you may not be able to take her plants. They may not transfer so well, but the Louisiana iris do really well here. I would say south of a line, say, of about evergreen, a lot of those bearded iris do not do well, and they have a really hard time. So that's why you've had it. You're a great gardener. Don't worry if your mother's, you're as good a gardener as your mother. But don't panic if you've had a hard time getting those iris to grow from Mobile. That's not your fault. That's the fact that the iris don't like living in this extremely wet, short winter, hot summer night climate. They have a hard time. Up around Troy, they'll do okay. They'll do even better in the Tennessee Valley. The farther north you move, the better those will do up to a certain point. But we do those incredible Louisiana iris, the wetland iris, really well. Really, really well. We should talk more about those. What else? I want to talk real quickly because we have a contest. Ben Averett won our contest. He's got a field of newly planted tomatoes. I hear he was very interested in winning the contest, and he did. So he's got what he gets from that, from winning our photo contest, which is on Facebook. Hold on. Let's talk about this. On Facebook, you can submit a photo of your garden, and it's voted on. And if you get enough votes, you win a poster. And the poster is the Plain Gardening planning wheel on this really sturdy paper. Now, there are other ways of getting that poster on less than sturdy paper. It's available on the internet, the Wonder Wheel, the Plain Gardening Almanac. But to have it on this really nice, solid paper that you can, solid poster that you can keep and reference all the time. You could put it in your shed and it won't deteriorate. It's kind of good. You know, you put your paper out in the shed and it turns brown and then gets wet and then it's a mess. So Ben won this. It's nice. We have a Facebook contest for the best photos. So if you go to Facebook, FM Talk 106.5 on Facebook, you can submit your photos there, and they can be voted on, and you may win the contest next week. Let me tell you something else about photos. If you've got other photos that you want me to answer questions on right away, you just text them to us. 251-343-0106. You just text them to us. People do it all the time. I'm sorting through them now. I'm looking at those photos. I'm trying to stay ahead. Ooh, somebody sent me a picture of a rattlesnake weed. It is absolutely beautiful. It is a beautiful, indeed, rattlesnake weed. Can it be eaten raw? Yes, indeed. Wash it off, just like you would a turnip root or anything else, and put it in your salad. It's absolutely delicious. I think raw is probably the best way. You can cook them lightly. They don't like to be cooked hard because you'll lose this delicate flavor, but they're really delicious. Really popular in lots of parts of the world. Rattlesnake weed. Great thing is what we call it. There's all kind of fancy French names, which I don't want to embarrass myself by trying to pronounce them. Hey, we're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106, or you can text us.
She loved her brother, I remember back when he was fixing up a 49 and in. He told her little sister gonna ride the wind up around the moon and back again.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Lots of things to talk about. Rusty asked me, and Rusty, I don't want to, I hope I don't get into one of these debates, but his wife bought a plant, and he's a little worried about it. Rusty, you're right to be worried. It's papyrus. It's, you know, it's very invasive. It can be very invasive. It's also frost sensitive, and we're on the border of the area where it's sort of on the one side of the line. It gets killed back every winter and won't survive. On the other side of that line, it becomes very invasive if the winter doesn't kill it back and can destroy a native plant communities. You know, you're right on that line, and it's here along the Gulf Coast. I worry about it, particularly in a wetland situation where things can be a little warmer than they are in the surrounding landscape. You don't get as And if it does become introduced into that bog, you could destroy the bog. It could destroy much more because you're in a very vulnerable place. I mean, at least from what I've seen in pictures of your yard, you're very close to a very important wetland and a very important wetland system. And it would be really, 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 you'd be upset if that plant got out and wiped out so many of the beautiful things. And not a lot of plants, not a lot of animals are going to know how to live with an Egyptian papyrus taking over their habitat. It doesn't provide the same sort of structure and food. It can be a big problem. So, yeah, I'd say don't do it. Now, it could be that we get a cold winter like we had this past winter. It probably would kill it. And we'd all be happier. But, yeah, not a great one. Not a great one. And it's debatable as to whether it should still be sold. I think it would be safe if you were to put it in a, like a little waiting pond kind of thing that was not connected to any natural system. It would probably be okay there. I don't think it seeds out very well. But don't put it in a native. Don't put it in a native area. I'd definitely say it'd be better not to do that. It would be much better not to do that. Josh wants to divide his gingers. There's a lot of different kinds of gingers. Josh, if it's the white flowered ginger, what we call the white butterfly ginger or white butterfly lily, sometimes it's called, they can be, you could move them now. That's as probably as good a time as any to move those. They'll move just fine. Now that the soil has begun to warm, we can move a lot of the tropical plants. So if you've got, if I told you to delay planting a citrus, well, plant it now because the soil is warm. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine along the Gulf Coast. Go ahead and do that now. Soil is warming up. Those kinds of plants, even palms that are sensitive to moving because they need warm soil to develop, now is the time to do palms. And the soil is warm enough that those roots will begin growing. Amaryllis, if you move an amaryllis now, you'll interrupt the flowering, but probably the bulb will do okay. They need that warm soil. And so, yeah, you can move gingers. And I would say for most gingers, this is probably the ideal time to move them right now. Probably the ideal time to move those gingers. Let's see. Who else have I got here? So Dan says his lady banks has bloomed for the first time in 3 years. And he sent me a picture of it. Really beautiful. It's the white flowered, double flowered lady banks. Lots of varieties out there. I used to think that lady banks did not have a chilling period that it went through. But based on recent experience along the Gulf Coast, it does seem to bloom much better after a cold winter. And we had a relatively cold winter, and it seems to be blooming better. So Lady Banks Rose may do a little better farther inland than it does along the Gulf Coast, particularly now that a lot of our winters tend to be a little milder. Not that we don't get one or two days of cold, but we don't often get an extended period with winter chilling with temperatures at 45 degrees or below. We did this winter. And a lot of things are going to be blooming. You know, you're probably even going to see Bradford pears blooming, which haven't bloomed in a long time because they finally got the winter chilling, and you get to smell that bottom of your feet sort of smell that those Bradford pears have when they bloom. Terrible smell on those pears. But lots of things are going to do well. And some say peaches and apples and other things that haven't done, that normally don't do well on the Gulf Coast because they don't get winter chilling, they're going to get enough chill. They've gotten enough chilling this past year that they're probably going to bloom this year, do a little better than they normally do. I think that's one of the reasons the azaleas actually look better, is we had a little bit of cold. A little bit more cold and a little bit steadier. Let's see here. And I'm having to do this on the fly. Is it too early to sow wildflower seeds along in Gulf Shores? You know, wildflowers, it depends on where you get your wildflower seeds from. If you're sowing California wildflower seeds, it doesn't matter when you sow them. They're probably not going to do that well here. We hope they don't. They probably won't. Texas wildflower seeds, they're not going to do that well here. There's a lot of different wildflowers along the Gulf Coast. I don't recommend getting a wildflower seed mix because it's inevitably not designed for the Gulf Coast. And you end up with, at best, two or three very weedy plants that just are an annoyance. And oftentimes, none of them actually do very well. And they don't act like wildflowers. You're not going to get... Let's... call me. Let's talk about what you mean by wildflowers. Let's talk about your yard, because your yard ain't wild anymore. You've done everything you can to make your yard not wild so that you can build a house on it and bring water to it and have air conditioning and park your car and have St. Augustine grass or whatever grass you have. It's not wild anymore. And so we have to think about it. Every wildflower in our yards is a cultivated plant. It's just like any other flower. It's cultivated. You have to put effort into it. If you want to grow native wildflowers, that's another story, and we need to talk about that, because you need a native habitat. You need to think about what makes a native habitat. And I'm happy to do that. It's fun. And in fact, I hope any of it's left. I doubt much of it's left. But if there's any native wildflower habitat left along the Gulf Coast, right there around Gulf Shores, it would be fun to talk about how to preserve it and how to do well by it. And we'll talk about that. We can certainly talk about that. So I can tell you, when is the best time to sow wildflower seeds? Probably never, if they're from a mix. There will be no good time. Can I root this azalea, says Ronnie. Ron, let me look at that azalea. That is a beautiful native azalea hybrid. I'm not sure which one. They are hard to root. They're much harder than some of the evergreens to root. You know, Ronnie, it's possible. I kind of doubt it. Just in general, I trust even I would. It's nice to have friends like Martin Vandergeesen who do that for us. Martin doesn't do it just for me, does it for you too. He runs a nursery. He knows how to propagate those things, and he does it a lot better than I can. And it takes a little bit of effort to get some of those native azaleas propagated. They're a little bit harder. They do better from the roots, but that one is not one that's going to do well from the roots. So I think that's going to be really, really tough. Let's see. Catherine says, I heard that you mentioned daffodils do better here than jonquils or vice versa, and I don't know the difference of the two. Could you shed some light on this? Probably said the vice versa. So in the jonquil group, the narcissus group, whatever we want to call it, narcissus, let's call them all narcissus. In that group, there are a lot of different, there are hundreds and hundreds of cultivars. If you want to grow daffodils, and there are some great daffodils that grow well for us. You want to grow daffodils that have a long history along the Gulf Coast, like Carlton, C-A-R-L-T-O-N. They don't need a lot of winter chilling, and they do very well for us, C-A-R-L-T-O-N. There are others. I won't remember them all off the top of my head. Campanelli is another one. And there are a bunch of others. So some daffodils do really, really well. Paper whites and other types of jonquils do really well. Let me just tell you what works. Forget classifications. They're in the narcissus group. Grand Primo is one of the great, great narcissus for the Gulf Coast. They're not as big as they don't have as big a flower as the daffodil, but boy, do they bloom big. I mean, you'll have tons of flowers. They're very fragrant. They bloom very early, and they do great. Grand Primo, and we've forgotten it. It's one of the great ones. So Carlton and Grand Primo. Thalia is another one that should do very well. It blooms a little bit later, but it can also do very well. So there's a whole list of those. And Catherine, what you should do is you should make me think about this in fall when you should actually be ordering these. So when it comes time to order daffodils, and really that is September for us, we need to be thinking about that in September. We order them in September. They'll be delivered in October, November, we plant them then. Let's think about it in September. What kind of narcissus should we order? And I can give you a list now, but then you're going to lose the list or you'll forget about it. But just make yourself a note. Let's talk about that in September when it's time to order those. Well, I hear some music. We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to be right back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah.
Sort of sweaty. The jasmine, they smell.
We're gonna answer some of these questions. I got lots of pictures of azaleas. You know, I've got a picture of azalea that is over from Ocean Springs. It's almost a burgundy color, and it's a southern group of azaleas we call Southern Indians, which are evergreen azaleas. They're not native, but they act like they're native. They grow very well here. At least they act like they're native to our yards. They probably wouldn't do that well in the woods. On their own. In fact, they wouldn't. They'd die out. But they do quite well in our yards. They're very good. They're actually a hybrid of mostly, I think, Japanese species. If Martin van der Giessen were here, he would jump on the phone and scold me that I simplified it too much. But it's mostly, I think, Japanese species that were hybridized years ago to produce these beautiful Southern Indians that do very well for us. They're our big hoop-skirted azaleas, the ones that get, as Hal sent me a picture earlier, 30 feet wide or the size of a house. I mean, just huge, immense azaleas, beautiful azaleas. And this one is burgundy-colored. It looks like Formosa, the classic old Formosa, but it's much darker. And there are two. And I'm going to say it's hard to tell from a picture on the, you know, that someone gets piped through the phone. But I'm going to say that this is probably Kissimmee. It's probably Kissimmee, which is one of my favorite colors. It could be Red Formosa. Red Formosa is a very dark burgundy, and a lot of plants have appropriated the name Red Formosa, but Red Formosa is the kind of classic name. It's burgundy colored. It looks like Elvis velvet. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of a spooky looking red. It's so dark reddish purple. It's kind of a velvet reddish, an Elvis velvet reddish purple, and it's spooky looking, and it could be that one, but I'm thinking it's not quite that burgundy, and so it's Kissimmee. Really nice Kissimmee, you know, like the town in Florida, not Kissimmee, but Kissimmee. A great old azalea, one of my favorites, one of my favorite colors. So it's one of those. I'll tell you, I would say it's one of those two. Rusty's got a plan. That's good, Rusty. I'm glad to hear that. Rusty's got a plan for that plant. And let's see who else. So Jim says, you know, he's noticed this year that that not only is he seeing bumblebees pollinating the blueberries, but he sees some honeybees too. And let me talk about bees just a second, Jim, and it's because it's useful to know. The honeybees are terrible pollinators. Let me repeat that. Honeybees are terrible pollinators. They're among the worst, and particularly for native plants like blueberries, because they're from Europe, and they don't do the kind of buzzing that native bees do that release pollen. So, for example, all native bees, including bumblebees and digger bees and carpenter bees and lots of others, euglossid bees, little metallic-looking bees that are really tiny, so tiny that you almost don't think they're bees, they're flies, but they're really quite beautiful. All of those do buzzing. They are buzzers. They are bumblers. They make a vibrating, a thing around the flower that releases the pollen. Honeybees don't do that, and so they're not very effective pollinators. Will they try to steal nectar from the flowers? Yes. But they're not going to effectively pollinate them. So one of the interesting things is, if you really want pollination, for most of the plants that do well along the Gulf Coast, you want native bees and not honeybees. Did I say that? I said that. And it's the truth. Now, let me tell you, I love honey. I am a honey bear. Gosh, do I love honey. And I like having honey. And it's a little bit of a dilemma for me, because I know that honeybees are their own sort of problem in nature. But it's probably okay to have a few hives for honey. I like to rationalize that, and I like having honey and having hives for honey. I used to keep bees. I used to have, when I was growing up, that's what we did. I mean, we had hives. I've been stung gajillions of times, learned how not to get stung gajillions of times. I loved having honeybees. I should have them again because of all of the honey I eat, but they are not good pollinators. So if you want honeybees, don't have them because you think they're going to help you with pollination. They won't. All the pollination that's going to be done in your garden, almost all of it, is going to be done more effectively by native bees. And that includes even things like tomatoes that don't normally get pollinated well. They don't actually do cross-pollination well. The natives are actually going to do better, oddly enough, on those tomatoes than the others. And it's because of that buzzing action of the bumblebees. Boom, boom, you know, that kind of, you can hear that. You hear that sound? That's me making a bumblebee sound. It's the buzzingness that vibration is what releases the pollen. Really interesting, really weird, kind of cool. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but it's a good thing to know. They're going to be the ones that are doing the pollination. And blueberries, 99.99% of the pollination of blueberries is done by native bees, not by honeybees. Important to know. My friend who has a beautiful azalea that I described as either Kissimmee or Red Formosa, and I can't quite tell from this picture via the internet which one it is. Could be either one. I'm kind of torn. almost a burgundy color. It wants to put a brick and grow a couple of the long limbs. When should I do that? So I think what he's saying is he wants to propagate it. So if you have an old Southern Indian azalea that you really like, and even if you don't know the name for it, Southern Indian azaleas are those evergreens that get to be so big. If you'll take a branch that's gotten very long and kind of leggy and that can lay over to the ground, and you take that branch and you lay it down to the ground and you let the... And what you want to do is you want to bury part of the tip. You want to leave about 6 inches sticking out of the ground with leaves on it. But you want to bury just before you get to the end, you want to bury it. So you kind of curve it down, you drop it down, you make a little curve into the ground, and that curve comes back out of the ground with some leaves on it. So you're just burying near the tip, about, 6 to 12 inches from the tip. You want to bury that limb. Before you bury it, take your fingernail and just scrape the bottom of it. Just scar it just a little bit with your fingernail. Just scar it just a little bit. And then put some soil over that, and then put a brick on it. And you know what'll happen? It'll develop roots, and you can propagate it. Did you get that? Gosh, I ran out of time. But we'll talk about that more when we come back. Hey, we're going to be back for another hour. I'm going to get to all these questions. Feel free to give us a call, 251-343-0106. You can text me pictures, too.
Eating beans and I'm making love as long as I am able.
It's Plain Gardening. for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Yeah, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning, Florida and Mississippi Sunday morning. Lots of flowers in bloom today. Of all different kinds. We started talking about bulbs. We feel obliged to talk about azaleas because the azaleas are really doing beautifully this year. The cool weather of the winter seems to intensify the colors a little bit. They're all doing. I've just seen nothing but beautiful pictures of azaleas. Really, really great looking things. There's so many different kinds of azaleas for the Gulf Coast. We ought to talk about that more. If you're confused about what kind of azalea you have, send me a picture. Let's try to talk about it and let's try to figure it out. There are some azaleas that don't do as well for us, and they're the ones, you know, they're because they had to come up with azaleas that did well in Michigan. And New Jersey, Michigan doesn't do that well for azaleas, I'll say. But New Jersey, and some of those azaleas don't do as well for us because they need more chilling. But no place has as great a variety of azaleas available to them as the Gulf Coast. Unbelievable varieties that can bloom over a huge long period. We don't talk enough about them. Mobile was once the azalea city. I should remind you of that. It's something that, you know, I don't beat dead horses. Mobile is not the azalea city anymore. I think it will take a big revival, a new generation to sort of rediscover that potential for that to happen. It won't happen with this generation, I'm quite sure. But you still need to know as a gardener that azaleas are incredible here. I mean, there's a reason we're the azalea city. There's a reason we were. And we do azaleas really well. All kinds of azaleas. Some of them hold their leaves all winter. They're evergreen. That's one group of azaleas. They're not native. But if you find the right evergreens, boy, do they do well. Those big hoop-skirted southern Indian azaleas, so-called, from Japan, mostly. But they do really well here because our climate's very similar to where those azaleas came from in Japan. And they are traditional on the Gulf Coast. They've been here for more than 100 years, much more than 100 years now. And they do very, very well. Some great pictures of them. We also have our native azaleas. And Alabama and Georgia are the world center for deciduous azaleas, azaleas that lose their leaves in winter. No place has a greater variety than this sort of area of around Alabama, Georgia, Northwest Florida. Incredible variety of azaleas. And we're finding new ones all the time. It's weird. It's just like we had so many that we didn't know what to do with them all. But there's some really cool ones. The Red Hills azalea is one of the new ones that we found that's in the Red Hills region around Monroe County, back through the central part of the state, but just absolutely amazingly tall, tree-like. Azaleas, beautiful things. We're finding them in the northern part of the state too, some newest species up there. And they're very fragrant, extremely fragrant, almost all of them. And they have these long tubes and these globe-like, the blooms form globes. They're really incredible, those native, beautiful, beautiful native azaleas. I did try to tell you about propagating, and two questions came up in the last hour. I want to clarify now. The native azaleas, the ones that don't have winter leaves, that lose their leaves in winter, the deciduous azaleas, they're pretty hard to propagate. They're pretty hard to propagate. It's possible. But you need to have propagated a lot of plants before you take that on. I honestly don't try to propagate those. If I did, I would do it from root cuttings, and that's another story, and I don't even think that a lot of them will do well from root cuttings, but we can talk about that sometime, and I'll have to think about it before I tell you to do what that to a native azalea. But they're hard. The Southern Indians, the evergreens, are very easy to propagate. And we were just saying in the last hour, if you find one that you like, one of those big hoop-skirted Southern Indians, as Clay says, the ones that they had a garden writer that said that one was as big as a Trailways bus. Yeah, okay, maybe. And they get very big. Does anybody remember what a Trailways bus looks like anymore? But they get big. And those big azaleas are very easy to propagate. It's one of the reasons they were so popular, is that they were easy to propagate. But you can layer them by taking a branch and laying it down on the ground, laying it down on the ground, bending that tip of that branch down onto the ground, burying the branch about 6 to 12 inches back from the tip so that the tip still sits up and gets some sunlight with leaves on it. But the area just behind that tip, you bury underground. You can kind of scrape it just a little bit before you put it in there. You can use a staple, like a little metal staple, to hold it in the ground. You can put the earth over it and then put a brick over it, but you want to hold it in the ground with a little bit of dirt over it. And it'll root. It'll develop roots there almost inevitably. If you want to be sure, do two or three or four branches. You'll probably have all of them root. Very successful, very easy way to do that. Fish Sniper wants to know, what time of year should I propagate it? You start it right now. It'll be ready. If you do it now, it'll be ready. It'll be ready to move this fall. You can cut it. Once it roots, you cut it off from the mother branch, and say in September and October, you'll have some roots on it. You cut it off from the mother. You just take a pruning shear and cut that branch that you laid down onto the ground. You cut it off from the mother plant, and you dig up the newly rooted plant, and you take it and you plant it. And fall is the best time to do it. And so right now is a great time. It'll probably start rooting in by June or July really well, maybe even by May. But the trouble is, you don't want to necessarily move it then. So just let it sit there. Just let it sit there gaining energy, and then move it this fall. Does that help? There you go. More pictures of azaleas, and it's a little fuzzy. I'm not sure which one it is, but nobody's asked me to tell them which one it is, so I guess I'm okay. It looks kind of like Pride of Mobile, to me. So somebody said my tomato and pepper seedlings were not a success this year. That's because they use that coconut fiber that I don't know how they pronounce it, because I'm not in a place where people use the word for coconut fiber all the time. We use other things, but coconut coir or coir or whatever you have, coir, whatever you, however you say it. Somebody help me. Somebody in the know. It's a coconut fiber to start the seeds in, and I don't know about that. I don't know about it. I think it would do just fine. I think the coconut fiber would do just fine. If you use pure coconut fiber, you have to recognize that the pH is probably just fine. Probably the water retention is just fine. It will, in general, a lot of those do not have any fertilizer in them. So once the plant germinates and gets its first set of true leaves, you will actually need to fertilize those. This is confusing because a lot of the planting mixes that you buy at the store now have fertilizer in them. This is good and bad. It's bad in most ways. But it gets people addicted to the idea that you... But in this case, when you use coconut fiber, I think it'll do just fine. I haven't used it before. I don't use it much because I don't live near many coconut trees, But if I use that coconut fiber, it's almost certain, it's almost a certainty that it's going to be processed in such a way that it will not have fertilizer in it, and you're going to have to add fertilizer once it gets the first true leaves. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why your tomatoes and peppers didn't do as well. The other thing is, make sure those tomatoes and peppers get plenty of sunlight as soon as they can. That's really very important. Very, very important. So the only question I have about core, the coconut fiber, however you pronounce the stuff, is that I don't know, you know, water management. Does it manage water really well? I think it probably is okay. I think it probably does fine. So I think it's okay to use, just you'll have to use fertilizer. What kind of mix would I use? You know, yeah, well, there's a bunch of mixes out there, and you use what you can find. But we'll be back after this break.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of rain next week. Led Zeppelin reminded me of that. That's going to be good. It's been a little dry. In fact, some places along the Gulf Coast are down over 30 days. They're below 50% of normal rainfall. And that can cause some problems later on. We will have, by the way, we will have dry weather in April and May. It's almost inevitable. It's going to heat up real quickly. The trees are going to suck all the water out of the ground. They're going to be active, and then it's going to dry out, and we're going to get these big, long gaps between rain, and that's when we start losing plants very quickly. So you have to be prepared for that. It's why March isn't always the best time to plant. Fall is often a better time to plant a wide variety of shrubs and trees. So if you're planting now, just be prepared to water. You're going to get water this week. That's great. That's very good. We need it along the Gulf Coast. April and May look to be, they're always going to have some dry moments, and it may be drier than normal this year, just because of some long-range forecast. Nobody can predict that perfectly, and I'm not guaranteeing it, but I guarantee that most years it's dry in April and May, so be prepared for some watering. What kind of soil mix? For starting seeds, I think there are a wide variety of soil mixes that can work. You just have to know the advantages and disadvantages of each one and figure out how to work around it. A lot of the fertilizers that you buy at the getting places, you know, they're going to have fertilizer in them. And that's not necessarily a great thing for starting seeds. It's better if you can control the fertilizer that goes into the seedlings. But you know what? I use them, and they work just fine because it's all I can get right now, and I need to be making my own. But making my own requires getting the raw materials, et cetera, et cetera. But you really want most of the stuff you can get at the getting stores is just fine. Just make sure it's a potting mix. Finer potting mixes are better for starting seedlings, and for growing plants out, you want a coarser mix. So which is which? You don't know. You never know. I mean, it's funny. The Miracle-Gro mixes, which have nothing special about them, it's just what there is available. They'll vary from being incredibly coarse where I can't, you know, I have to pick out all the big pieces to start seeds, to being really fine. And it's just a matter of what they decide their mood, I guess. It's very undependable. But you shop around, and sometimes you get a mix that's a little coarse for starting seedlings, and you have to fix that. The coconut is going to be just fine. I think the coconut fiber, which is has this name, C-O-I-R, which I'm tempted to call core, but I don't know. That works fine. You're just going to have to fertilize it, and that's good. That's a good thing. You can control the fertilizer when you apply it. Maybe I should be using it more, except, again, I don't live near any coconut trees. But there it is. Somebody said loquat production. What's loquat production going to be like this year? That's a good question. You know, here's an interesting thing. I think loquats survive fairly cold temperatures as long as those cold temperatures don't hit when the flowers are being produced. And we had some cold days this winter, but it could be that it doesn't affect the loquats at all, because oftentimes the cold temperatures are more devastating at flowering time than they are during fruiting time. So just that thought. I don't know. We'll see. Cameron just planted a sweet bay magnolia tree, and it had multiple trunks, typical of a sweet bay. Don't plant a sweet bay too close to your house because they get really big. You know that, right? And they're not very wind firm. And so they can fall on your house. And if they get really big when they fall on your house, it can do a little bit of damage. Plant it well away from your house when you plant it, if you can. Because we're talking about a tree that gets, I've seen them 60, 70 feet tall with really heavy trunks. Maybe even taller, but they're not at all wind firm. So be careful about where you plant it. But yes, you can trim it back to three trunks, and that's what I would recommend. I think that's a good plan. They're very ornamental that way, and yeah, just take out and in this case, you want to take out the smallest ones and cut them back to the base. Just cut them back to the base. Take out the smallest ones. Leave the biggest ones. And that's the way to go. And now's the time to do it. It'll be fine time to do it. I did get another. Let me go back to this one. A question that I got earlier. And then we're going to get to some phone calls. But somebody sent me a picture of a shrub. And it's about 15 feet tall. And I'll tell you, if you were to take that shrub, and it's an evergreen, if you were to take that shrub and rub those leaves in your hand, they would smell like almonds. And the smell of almonds is the smell of cyanide. which is a very common component of things in that family. It's in the rose family. It's in the apple family. It's Carolina laurel cherry. It's Carolina laurel cherry, and it's sort of a native plant. It is a native plant. It loves urban areas, and it comes in as a weedy thing around urban areas. Carolina laurel cherry is what you're looking at. Coir, somebody who says, who knows. I'm fine with that. Coir, C-O-I-R, coir, not core. Any rate. I don't live around coconut trees, so I don't know the language of coconut trees that well. Coir is what I'm informed is called. Cameron says his magnolia is far away from the house. Yep, and the silvery leaves are very pretty in the wind, aren't they? Good. Hey, Jim. Jim's calling in about oak trees. I'm listening. What's up, Jim?
Well, I bought a house that has this big, beautiful oak tree in the front yard. It did well during hurricane season this year, but I need to have somebody come and look at it and tell me, you know, what I need to do. But just looking in the Yellow Pages or online, I don't know what kind of tree service to get. Can you give me an idea of what I need? Because, like, it's got a lot of, like, ferns growing on some of the the big limbs that come out. I don't know whether that's good for it or not.
Yeah, the ferns are probably just fine. They do add a little extra weight, but as long as the limbs aren't too far away from the trunk, I don't think the ferns make a big difference at all. The ferns actually aren't living. They're not doing anything to the tree except adding weight. They're actually living on just detritus and rainfall. So they're a nice feature of the tree. But yeah, let's talk about who you get. Because we have some people who advertise on our show who are very good. I know Chris Francis advertises on our show, and it's not because he advertises on our show. I've known Chris for years, and I know he's very good, and he's not a mortician. And I divide tree people into two types. Morticians, I'm a mortician. I cut trees down. I was trained to cut trees down. I know how to deal with trees that are dead. Chris Francis is a surgeon. He deals with living trees mostly, and helps you to figure out how to make sure that living tree doesn't get too big for its britches. Sometimes limbs get way too wide, and there's not enough connection to the trunk, and he can look at that and tell you. But anybody who's and Chris would tell me to say this, anybody who's a certified arborist, who has the certified arborist attached to their name, they're going to be trained to teach you how to help you understand what to do with your tree. And some certified arborists are better than others. I can say that, but looking for the certified arborist label. And that will help you. Does that help, Jim?
Yeah. I just didn't know what to do on that. So because I've had tree people back when I lived other places that just came and trimmed up trees, but
didn't know what they were doing.
They were arborists, and I want this tree to live.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you can do a lot of crazy things to trees, and I'm going to come back when we get back from this break, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the general things you want from your trees. Hey, Jim, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. A few things about oak trees. So what do you worry about where, and I have a feeling this is a live oak we're discussing here because of the ferns growing on the limbs. Those are not parasites. They just they're looking for a place to land. They're looking for a platform. And there are lots of plants like lichen and certain types of ferns that just look for a platform, a place where they can get above the fray and get some sunlight, right? Sunlight's what most plants feed on. And so if they can hitch a ride on the upper parts of branches, that's where they'll live. And that doesn't mean they're parasites. Now, there are some parasites that do live on those branches too, and they hitch a ride. They are parasites, and mistletoe is one of those. You will see mistletoe on certain types of trees that are vulnerable to it. There's always a lot of mistletoe in Midtown Mobile. It's everywhere because of the water oaks and some other trees that really support pecans, support it. A lot of other trees that don't have a good immune system support it. But most of the things that grow on live oaks are not parasites. They just are looking for a platform. They may add some extra weight, but the extra weight is not a problem on a tree unless the limbs get too big for their britches. And when they start stretching too far away from the trunk, it's a lever. And that lever can shear off from the trunk, and that can cause a big problem. If you think about trees that grew in the woods, even in the native stands of live oak, and live oak was not common. It was very uncommon until we created cities and decided that we wanted nothing but live oaks. And that's something to think about. But in the beautiful, beautiful live oak strands that are still left, that are where there are native live oaks, even in those strands, the trees are not wide. They're often much taller than they are wide, because that's the way trees grow in a forest. But when we grow them in an open-grown situation, those limbs can get and stretch and stretch and stretch and stretch and get way too big for their britches. And they have no way to support themselves, and they start shearing off from the trunk. And we see that a lot. We see that a lot. And so you have to be careful about that. And that's one of the things we want to look for on those live oaks. That's going to be your biggest problem on the live oak, that and root damage. You want to protect the roots. You want to keep the limbs from getting too big for their britches. Those are going to be the two big problems. John, I'm listening. So what got you started on propagating hickory trees?
We have a bunch of hickory trees on our place, but they're not spread all over, and I want to put them in some places where we don't have them now. So what I've done, I rotted down a pile of leaves. I broke the ground with the spade, and then I rotted down a pile of leaves on top of it. And it's ready to go now, and I'm wondering, can I just put hickory nuts out of the yard in that pile and let them go?
That's the only way to do it. There is only one way. I mean, it's a good thing hickory's got nuts, because there ain't no other way to propagate them in any kind of efficient way. So the nuts work really well. But, you know, the nuts are composed of basically three parts. The outer husk, the thing we call the husk. And so once they emerge from their husk, you've got the nut. And the nut itself can be planted. It should be planted in winter. Is the best time to plant it. A lot of them have some winter chilling that needs to be done and some vernalization. They need to stay wet and cold for a while before they germinate. But as soon as those nuts come out of the husk, you want to plant them and put them in the ground. And they'll sprout. A huge percentage of them are going to sprout. I'd put three or four nuts per pile of leaves to make sure that, you know, that worms hadn't gotten to some of the kernels on some of them. But they're going to do really quite well if you do that. And that's the best way to do hickories. I'll also tell you, because they have a deep taproot. Most of the hickories have pretty deep taproots. Not all of them, but most of them do. And they don't do well in a pot for very long. So there you go. Yeah, I mean, I think you're doing it right. Did you gathered some nuts last fall? Have you got the nuts?
Yeah, I've got some nuts, and there are more on the ground still that squirrels haven't gotten yet. But yeah, that's what I'm going to try. I'm just going to stick them in the pile and see what happens.
Yeah, it sounds good. I will tell you that the ones that have stuck around all winter that weren't buried probably have worms in them.
Okay.
A huge percentage. So not all those may germinate. So put several in each pile of leaves. And then next fall, if you do it again, I would, as soon as they emerge, drop out of the husk, then bury them, and you're much less likely to get worm problems in them that way.
Sounds good. I'll try this and see what happens.
All right. Great. Tell me how it goes, John.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Ryan? Yeah, the blueberries are flowering. They're flowering really well, and just about all over Alabama, I think the blueberries are flowering. What's going on with yours?
I was just wanting to know if I need to pick them off. I just got them, like, last September in the ground, and I didn't know if I needed to pick off the, you know, the first groups of them to help establish them, or just let them do their thing.
Ryan, what a great question. You know, do you remember what kind of blueberries they were?
Two different varieties. It's, I don't. One was a Premier, maybe one was a Climax. Don't get me
wrong. Oh, beautiful.
I'm not 100%.
You're good. That's all I need to know. I know enough. So what I know is you've got rabbit eyes, and rabbit eyes tend to be thrifty about producing their fruit. They know when to produce their fruit. They're good that way, and they don't overproduce. So I don't think you'll have to do much trimming this year. You'll be fine with the rabbit eyes. I have never thinned. I've never thinned the fruit off a rabbit eye. You probably won't have many fruits this year because they're smart that way. They may set a lot of flowers, but they won't produce many fruits, and they won't overstress themselves. Some other varieties, which are good, and they produce good fruit, but they're not very smart. They're not thrifty about producing fruit, and so they'll tend to kill themselves by overproducing early in life. But you've got Rabbit Eyes, and if you've got Premier and Climax, those are two good varieties. You won't have any problem, and they'll be just fine. Leave them alone. Okay. They'll be okay.
Okay. All right, but my citrus, I got another question if you got time for it.
Yeah.
My citrus, I got a lemon, a lime, and a Satsuma tree. I do need to trim the fruits off of them, right?
If they're recently planted, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. If lemons and limes, you know, if they're in the ground, they're not going to survive for very long.
Mm-hmm.
Are they in the ground or are they in a pot?
They're in the ground.
Mm. Limes just do not like it in the ground. If you've recently planted that lime, go ahead and, if you can, dig it up and put it in a pot. Because it's going to die. Because it can't take the cold. Where other citrus can. Lemon, tell me, do you know what kind of lemon you had?
It's a Meyer lemon.
Meyer's lemon's great, so leave it in the ground. It's fine. I don't think Meyer's lemons, you probably won't get any fruit on it. If you do, go ahead and pick it off.
Okay.
But the lime, I would go ahead and move it. I would move it into a pot, and they do really well in pots.
Say that again?
Yeah. They do really well in pots. Okay. Limes do.
Okay.
So, and that way you won't lose it because, you know, I'm surprised you didn't lose it this past winter. Did you cover it?
Well, I just planted it like a couple of days ago. I just bought them here.
Oh, perfect.
About a week ago. Perfect.
Then it's really going to be easy to dig it up.
Yeah.
dig it up. Dig it up. Put it in a pot because it ain't going to survive in the ground.
Okay. All right. I'll do that.
All right. Good, Ryan.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you. Let's see here. Look at that. So, Sean, is that thing blooming now already? It looks like it. I mean, it kind of looks like. I mean, that's amazing. But those are beautiful. So it's one of the Cajun hibiscus. A bloom has got the Cajun hibiscus. That's really good to know. I think those Cajun hibiscus are great. They're beautiful, and it's really, really nice to have somebody selling those. A-Bloom Garden Center, because otherwise you can't get them. And they're really beautiful things. Look at that beautiful flower on that Cajun hibiscus. Put that on the Facebook page. Sean, put that picture on the Facebook page so people can see it. Everybody will be able to see it. You know what our Facebook page is? FM Talk 106.5. You know how to get to Facebook? I don't know how to get to Facebook. You know how to get to Facebook, don't you? Yeah, actually, I do kind of know how to get to Facebook. You go on Facebook and go to FM Talk 106.5. Post that picture there so people will see it. Just as a Cajun hibiscus, you might even win the contest with it. But I want people to see it. That's my thing. Because it's really beautiful. Really looks beautiful. Is it a bad idea to dig up and plant one of these Carolina laurel cherries? I think it looks nice. If you've got one Carolina laurel cherry, you're going to have 15 billion Carolina laurel cherries. All you need to do is turn around for about 3 months, and you will have, once they start fruiting, you will have so many Carolina laurel cherries, you won't know what to do with them all. Because they come in really well from seedlings. And that's the problem with Carolina laurel cherries is they're very weedy. I don't think you need to replant it. I don't think you need to dig it up and replant it. It's too big. I mean, the virtue of digging up a 15-foot Carolina laurel cherry is that you might kill it. And then you'll be spared all the seedlings that are going to come up around it. But if you want some seedlings, they'll be up around it. They're in your yard. Just take a look for them. I'm sure they're already there. If they're not, they're going to be there very soon. So I wouldn't dig it up. That's not going to be a lot of work. All right, we're going to be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. So onions, speaking of bulbs, when do onions start bulbing? And you know, some may never bulb. Some may never bulb. You got to have the right varieties of onions. And let me know what kind of varieties you planted, where you got them from. But many will never bulb here because we think the world was created in Northern Europe. It wasn't. Northern Europe and came to the scene quite late in the thing. But we have developed plants that will do well in places like Northern Europe. And Europe, you've got to remember, has a much higher latitude than we do. Oh, you don't want to remember all that. But I'm just telling you, that's the truth. It's much closer to the Arctic. And that means they have much shorter days in winter. Very short days in winter. Very little sunlight in winter. And very long days in summer. And so they have onions that are adapted to that, and they're called long-day onions. We have something called short-day onions, and we need to grow short-day onions. So, for example, the Texas Grano hybrids are short-day onions. We had a lot of the old Bermuda onions. Did I pronounce that right? It seems like I never pronounce Bermuda right. But the old Bermuda onions were short-day onions. They worked for us. But a lot of onions that are quite popular out there that they sell on the Internet, they're designed for long days like north of Tennessee. So there you go. If you planted a short-day Texas Grano hybrid onion, it should start bulbing about now. It should start bulbing about now. If you didn't, you could have a problem. Dan, do you really want to propagate wisteria? Now, Dan, just let me tell you, you know, if you don't have, listen, folks, if you don't have Asian wisteria in your yard already, you go home and you say a prayer of thank you. Because if you ever have Asian wisteria, any of the Asian wisterias in your yard, you will fight it for the rest of your days. I mean, it comes up everywhere from the roots. And a lot of times it takes years for it to flower because it's so aggressive vegetatively. And then when it finally decides it's taken over your yard, it'll then flower. But I don't recommend propagating it. Can you propagate it by layering? Oh, I don't even want to say it out loud, Dan, but yeah, you can. But please think about it carefully. Now, if you've got a native wisteria, and let's be careful when we understand that native is not one of those wisterias that are growing wild on the street. They're growing wild. Wisterias that are so common here, and yeah, they could be propagated by layering too, but be very careful about that. Can you do it by layering? Yes. I got an amen from Ronnie. I guess that means Ronnie is saying a prayer of thank you that he does or doesn't have. Maybe he's saying a prayer of what do I do about this Asian wisteria in my yard. Is that right, Ronnie? I don't know. You just don't want it in your yard. It's a mess, Dan. Oh, it's a mess. Let's see what else we got that I haven't gotten to yet. That we need to get to. We got all of our people that we dealt with. Yeah, we got all of our phone calls dealt with. Ronnie says he's been fighting Asian wisteria for 25 years. If you've got Asian wisteria, you will fight it for as long as you live. There it is. It is a terrible plague. And one interesting thing is, it is blooming now. If you're seeing it along, there's a good rule. If you find this wisteria in somebody's yard, or if you find it growing on telephone poles, along streets, or in trees along streets, and it's blooming now, I guarantee you it is not native. It is an Asian wisteria that has been introduced and spreads like wildfire. It grows faster than kudzu. It is harder to control than kudzu. Yeah, it is harder to control than kudzu. Absolutely. 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 I can give you 15 gajillion ways to get rid of kudzu. I don't know how to... Asian wisteria just... It almost defies control once it gets into your yard. You can knock it back a little bit, but it is very hard to control. So, just by the way, we have a native wisteria that does beautifully here. It just does beautiful. It doesn't come up from the roots. It's a beautiful thing. People have been propagating it. It grows wild in the Mobile Tensaw Delta. It's really nice. It grows up the Alabama River. There's some beautiful forms of it. If you can find that, it's the wisteria to have. It's the wisteria we started with before we imported the Asian and it escaped and went everywhere. There you go. Barry wants me to, and Barry, I meant to say something. So Barry poked at me a little bit and I said, you know, bearded iris are really hard on the Gulf Coast, and they are. And Barry has got one growing in a container. Let me say that if you're going to grow bearded iris, you're going to have better success in a container than you will in the ground. The ground is just too wet. It stays too wet here. People who grow bearded iris in the ground, it just rots out in most of Midtown Mobile. It may do a little better in West Mobile, but I found that even in West Mobile, they don't do well. And so that leads me to believe that there's something about our winter temperatures that are encouraging certain soil rots. There's something going on. It's not just there's something going on. Now, here, Barry's got one growing in a container on Fish River. And I will not rule out that you can get it to bloom, because Barry's got proof in a container. And that may be the way I would do it, but soil rots are terrible in most other places. I also think there's a winter chilling issue, and Barry, it may be if you've had that one bloom for you repeatedly in a container over many years, that's interesting. If it bloomed this year, it may be because we had a particularly cold winter, and it got enough winter chilling. I think that winter chilling is an issue for these guys. Could be wrong, but I think it is based on some of the things I'm seeing. But I can guarantee you bearded iris just don't do well in the ground. Can somebody prove to me that it does? Well, maybe. But most people are, and this all started because somebody said, look, I can't grow my mother's bearded iris in the ground in Mobile. Yeah. So this one, Barry salvaged it from ones that he planted in the ground. It has bloomed for several years. So that's good to know. Apparently the ones in the ground didn't do so well, I guess, Barry. And boy, this is cutting that conversation off too soon. But Barry, you call me back and scold me next week if you've had some bloom in the ground as well. Hey, folks, it's been fun. We'll be back next week. Give us a call.